Hi, my name's Tyler Ford from Westfield, Indiana. Thanks for listening to the Crown Refs podcast. Serve the game.
I'd like to welcome our next guest to the Crown Refs podcast, the 16-year official from Westfield, Indiana, a husband, a father of two who spent four seasons in the WNBA and six seasons in the G League, including the 2015 G League Finals, and on August 28, 2015, at age 30, became a full-time NBA official, and spent the last six seasons in the NBA working over 233 regular season games, including four playoff games. It's my honor to introduce Mr. Tyler Ford. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you? It feels weird hearing 16 years of refereeing experience. It goes by quickly. So, yeah, I'm good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, real quick, just take me through that day, August 28th, 2015, when you got the call up to the NBA.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing is sort of when you get to that stage, you think there's a chance. And so we got a phone call, and I say we because I know that Mitch and G, who I both got hired with, got like a same phone call. It was weird. I was working out at lunchtime at work, and I came back and I had a voicemail from New York, and I thought, oh my, this could be it. And it was Mike Banham who was making those kind of phone calls, and he wanted me to call him back. And so your heart like immediately starts racing. And he asked like three like interview kind of questions, like what I thought my top three strengths and weaknesses were. And he's like, okay, thanks. And it was like, what the heck just happened? Because, you know, you people that get hired in front of you sort of kind of know what the process kind of is. And I had to leave for a WNBA game that day. I was going to Washington. And actually, that happened around lunchtime. And then I was on the economy shuttle heading to the terminal in Indianapolis and got another call around 5:15, 5:20 that I had gotten hired. And so like that's just one of those moments that there's just a great deal of excitement. You know, call my wife, call your mom and dad. And then I was trying to figure out how I could get off that flight and stay home and not travel to the next day. But that's a really cool moment, you know, and you don't get a lot of those moments in refereeing. And so it's fun to sort of enjoy and embrace those really positive milestones. So that it was a really cool day.
Thanks for sharing that moment. I'm sure many officials wish they got the call that you got on that day. I know there's the 2021 season has been about a month in, a historically quick turnaround to start the season. Obviously, that was jump-started by what transpired last season with the stoppages of games in March to the resumption of play in the NBA bubble this past summer. NBA did a phenomenal job executing on the safety protocols, keeping all the participants healthy and the games running on schedule. So I just wanted to hear your perspective on what it was like living and working for so long in the NBA bubble.
I think going in, we all sort of understood that this was going to be a historical moment, you know, and things that we, you know, something we were going to talk about probably for the rest of our career. I think there was, you know, at least for me personally, I don't know that I had a great deal of stress with thinking it wasn't going to be safe. Like, you know, the NBA and these health and safety protocols are 70 page documents and they're extremely thorough, and you know, you're getting tested every day and and all the other protocols that were in place. You know, it wasn't that. It was how are we, you know, what are we going to do to be able to keep ourselves, you know, busy during all the downtime, you know, because you start running the numbers and you know kind of how many games you're going to work. And you're thinking, I'm going to work like 10 or 11 games over the course of, you know, maybe 70 or 80 days. Like, that's a lot of downtime. And so I think a lot of it was, what do we pack and what do we bring with us? And then what are they going to have for us to do? And so, you know, that we had a 7-day quarantine when we got there, which you think about it, and you're like 7 days stuck in your room. It wasn't as bad maybe as I thought it was going to be. I think it helped that there were 45 referees sort of all doing that together, and so we were, talking, text message or FaceTime or, playing games and kind of that kind of stuff sort of kept us busy and, kind of play. We did a couple, rule sessions during the week, because we had a long layoff. I mean, that was part of the worry too, is what's it going to feel like refereeing in this environment? We hadn't refereed for a while, and it was really kind of the longest layoff that most of us had had. And I think that most of the people probably listen to this can relate to the long layoff between games. The NBA really did a great job. I mean, there was things that they adapted and adjusted as we got there. Once we got out of quarantine, we had a couple days worth of training camp. And then we kind of got into preseason games. There were, I think each of us had like 2 or 3 preseason games to just sort of kind of get your legs under you and adjust. The biggest adjustment, we had whistle covers, and then they had this plexiglass around the table. And so everybody had a microphone so you could communicate with the table. So adjusting to those two things, you were sort of adjusting to a new environment. I mean, I remember the first time that we had walked in, they brought us over on buses during training camp to see the arenas that they had built. And when you first walked in there, it was like really impressive. I remember like telling some of my friends that weren't on staff, like what they did here was really cool. They had these video screens around and it had a big stage feel. And so it was pretty cool to see, how they had modified for not having fans in there to make it feel like a big stage. And it sort of did that. You really miss the fans and the energy they provide. And so that was definitely, different, but the game was maybe the most normal thing that we had. I think off the court, it was trying to find stuff, that we could do and keep ourselves busy. And, Scott being a big pickleball person, I know that got a lot of media attention. And it was sort of in a center location that, the teams, they had, the Coronado Springs was a resort and it has like a convention center sort of in the middle, which was all, every team had a meeting space and that's where they did their film, but all your meals had to be eaten in the meeting space. And so we had a fairly large, they gave us a really nice, it was a big, basically a convention hall set up where we had a classroom set up with a projector where we had meetings and stuff, but also there was a couple TVs and areas we could break down tape and a meal area with snacks and drinks and whatever you needed and coffee like throughout the day. Eric Lewis had brought his golf net and we had people, hitting, balls into the golf net, and there were ping pong tables and pool tables and some gaming systems. And then they had sort of built us like a makeshift fitness center. And then eventually we had a basketball hoop in the back. I know people were, doing like around the world and different stuff. So, pickleball kind of became the game from in the morning from 9 to 12, 12:30 or whatever. And, there was another group of people that would go on, 3-5 mile walks. And so there was a group that walked and there was a pickleball group. And then, other people had other fitness things that they were doing. And then, there were some people that swam, and then, there was a group of people kind of in the afternoon that would kind of hang out at the pool. And there was an evening group of people that hung out at the pool. And then, dinner time, I felt like there was a decent amount of people that would sort of watch games, maybe in our meeting space. There was a sports bar in that, convention building that you could have some non-Disney food and watch, watch games and stuff. So you kind of adjusted and kind of got into a routine, I would say, for the first, 50 days or so. It wasn't too bad. And I think it maybe made it easier because you had like an expectation you were going to be there for a while. And the nice thing was, like, from the regular season to the first round, there were games coming on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And so there was something to do all day. And at that time, you were sort of working every other day or every 2 days. you know, we got to the second round and people started going home and you had been there for a while. There wasn't as much to do, you know, because I had a week layoff at one point. And normally when you're in the playoffs, you would be home during those days. So, you know, a week off doing the same thing you had done, you know, for so many days, that's where, it kind of got challenging. And then the third round, me and Ben and Curtis went to the Waldorf was where they had the replay staff, because the replay, it was sort of its own bubble, not as restrictive. And so there was a little bit of, I don't know if you want to call it excitement, but you got to move locations and we were able to Uber Eats and, you know, there was a golf course there we could play golf, you know, every day. So that made it nice, but we knew we were going home at the end of the round. So the faster that round had gotten over, you know, the better and the quicker you got home. So 79 days in all, it was an experience for sure. I don't think that you'll forget. But I'm glad, you know, you just miss your family being gone that long. It's a long time, but I mean, part of it felt like you were at, you know, kids camp with the guy, you know, that's kind of what it was. And trying to, you know, do some work, but you have way more days off than you had days that you were working. So,
you know, with refereeing, we formed so many great relationships with our partners, with travel and being at war together. But you are quite a unique scenario. I'm sure you already had some great relationships with your NBA brethren, but this probably brought you guys and ladies even closer together, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, some of my best friends are on staff, and you think about it, like, we rarely get to see each other. I mean, we have training camp in a typical year in September where we're all together for 5 days. And then, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you get two or three games during the season, and that's really it. Like, right, you don't get to see it. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely spent more time together than we ever had. And so, yeah, I think that from a relationship standpoint, certainly enhanced and grew other relationships that maybe you didn't have with people. And so, yeah, it was definitely a good opportunity to be around each other. And sometimes it's like any family, right? Sometimes that's good and bad. Yeah. So, but I would say mostly good, you know, especially for our group. And there was enough space where it's just impossible for 45 people to be best friends. You know, you think about, even like, you could see it. I heard some of the teams, you know, like even amongst 15, like they're not all traveling in one group or, you know, together. So, you know, people had different relationships with people, and, you know, if it was groups of 5 to 6 to 10 or whatever, you know, that was cool. And people sort of found their niche in what really ultimately allowed them to survive a really long time, because it did weigh on people. Like, I remember Monty at one point saying, this is a little harder than I thought it was going to be, you know. And we were able to play golf, you know, one day a week. You know, they had golf courses sort of privatized, and then there were a couple opportunities where more had come up, and, you know, a couple times Monty had just ordered pizza for the group and we had watched movies. It was just things to do that were, you know, that were different. But I'll definitely remember, I mean, watching, you know, game sixes and game sevens and some games where we had 20 people sitting there watching and the games coming down. It was fun. Like, that, those were kind of, you know, cool things that maybe you only get at like a summer league kind of environment. So, yeah, it was definitely unique.
I appreciate you sharing your bubble experience. You know, on this podcast, one of the subject areas we've been spending a lot of time on lately is mental makeup and mindset, and really developing that thick skin and toughness to deal with the wide range of difficulties that officiating presents. I know this is something that you are passionate about, so I was hoping you could do a little deep dive into the mental aspect of the game.
Yeah, I think processing information at a high rate of speed and then the amount of information you're able to process, you know, really kind of separates people. And we'll look at this from maybe a play calling perspective first, but you have plays that are just clearly a foul and clearly not a foul, and they meet the standard of just what a foul is. That maybe doesn't take as much mental capacity as these plays that are tweeners, that are 50-50 plays that we would say are in the gray. And there's different shades of gray, and some games have more plays than others. But things that can help you make really good decisions in that gray may include time and score. It may include personal fouls and team fouls and sequences and just sort of how this game is going and how much of that information you have at your disposal and how fast your computer can sort of process that and give you a decision is going to separate. And so some of that, it may also be recall from what a play looks like that you've seen, you know, before, either through your experiences, your career, through video, whatever it may be. And so there's a lot of thinking, and I think that being able to think your way through and make really good decisions. Early on, I remember sort of being more of a black and white person, you know, when you first start off, and I don't think that's bad. But there is a lot of, there's a lot of gray in what we do as referees. And so the more information that you have at your disposal, that you can utilize on the floor to make really good decisions, is only going to help. Now, I do think that, you only have room maybe to process so much information. And so I think that somebody could be listening to this and be like, oh yeah, you know, like I aspire to have all this information, you know, available. I do think, like, from, if you're focused on maybe your body posture or, you know, where you're standing at trail or lead, those are maybe things that I don't maybe think about. You know, I think you try to master your body posture and your mechanics where they become second nature and you're not taking up mental capacity to think about those things. So then you can think about, all right, when I blow my whistle, I'm putting them on the free throw line because we have 16 fouls. Or you just pick up the fact that that guy or girl has 4 fouls. And so like this foul is putting them on the bench. Like being able to recall quickly, or we just had a similar play on the other end, we no-called it. Like you have to sort of slow yourself down. Like you have to be thinking through the next play. But if you're so worried about maybe how you're running or how you're standing or your posture, you're probably not thinking that stuff through. So you do have to kind of take this in steps where you free up your mind to sort of think about other things. And there's all this other stuff that happens in the midst of the game. You know, you think about, you call a foul, you're trying to communicate that foul to the table, but you're also probably getting some sort of potential pushback from the sideline, maybe that player. And you're trying to communicate that play. You're thinking about the play emotionally, potentially. Right. You're listening to the PA announcer to make sure that they said it properly. You're looking up at the scoreboard to make sure that they put the team foul up. Maybe you forgot about if we're in the penalty or not. And so there's all these things that are happening. So your ability is to sort of compartmentalize everything that's happening and staying calm and trusting and being confident, and then moving to the next part of maybe communicating whoever you have to communicate. There's a lot that kind of goes on. And so hopefully you've kind of prepared yourself for that moment. And so then I think the mental aspect also kind of goes, what do you do leading up to the game? And so, you know, confidence is a really big thing in refereeing. And if you don't have confidence or your confidence is a little shaken, it's hard to then go out in this environment where you're making decisions that probably make half the people upset every single time that you make a decision. It's hard to project then strength and confidence, because it's really what we got to do to be a successful referee, if you're a little shaken inside. And so you have to have this inner belief, and it's not arrogance. It's confidence that you're really good at this and you're one of the best people at doing this and believing in yourself. But you build that up through really good habits. And so, you know, I think that, you know, people are going to put doubt in your mind throughout the game. Doing good video work and having experiences and seeing this play over and over and over again, that gives you an inner confidence that you probably got that play right because your recall, you know, helped you call that play. You know, I remember Steve Jabby, and I think it was like on a court club call when I was, this is maybe 10 or 12 years ago at this point, but I remember him talking about players like having doubt. Like everybody has doubt, players, coaches, like they put doubt in your mind. Like there are definitely plays that you're 100% sure on, but you're not 100% sure on every single play. So, you know, if there's there's a referee out there that goes, yeah, it's okay. Like, it's okay to have doubt. They're going to put doubt in your mind. But I think mentally what you have done leading up to that and how much work you are. And if you don't look at tape, you're never going to know if, you know, it, what that play actually looks like outside of what you thought you saw in that moment. And I think that really helps. And then you watch games and you watch other referees and guess what? Like, people make mistakes. And I tell young people all the time, like, the replay center is one of the best places to be. You know, when you're young and maybe in your first year, you see everybody's mistakes and everybody makes them, you know? And, you know, I think the thing about sort of kind of like professional golfers, like Tiger Woods hits bad shots. Normally his bad shots just aren't as bad as your, you know, mine and yours, you know? And so, you know, if we spray something left or right, it's going 60 yards left or right. For him, it's maybe 5 or 10. And I think that's kind of how professional referees are too. Like, our mistakes maybe just aren't as big, you know, it's the width of where those errors, you know, or somewhere kind of in between. You know, I think mentally too, that you have this self-talk element of what you're sort of doing in the middle of the game. And a lot of our self-talk, I think, in refereeing is sort of designed to slow us down or to keep us calm. And maybe for some people it is to make them more aggressive. But a lot of these start, develop, finish, and keeping your air low and sort of where you distribute your weight, you know, in your feet is really more designed to give you as much time to make a decision as possible and not immediately reacting to contact. But having that inner voice to be confident and then have a place to go where if chaos and it hits the fan, you got some place to go, because occasionally like the reset button has to happen. You know, there's, you're just going to have maybe a sequence, or you're going to get rattled a little bit. And then, you know, what do you do? You know, I don't know how often we necessarily talk about that, but you know, take a deep breath. You know, for me, I just sort of like kind of tap my right leg a little bit. It's something that I kind of, it's just a lick, a little bit of a trigger to release, take a deep breath. And then I do sort of like kind of pump myself back up. Like, you're pretty good at this. You're going to be fine. We've been here before. Like, let's go, you know, and you just move on. But you sort of want to kind of take it back to the basics. And in these moments of chaos, you just revert back to your training and habits, and you call the obvious. And if you get a little rattled, hopefully it comes back, but we're just not 100% every night. And anybody that says that they are is lying to you. Like, there's just some nights we see the floor, and I kind of call this like a mental sharpness rating. We sort of joke about it internally, a couple of us, but sometimes your eyes are just seeing things, you know, in high definition and slow motion. And other nights things are just a little quick, you know, like come off of a long layoff. Think about that first game. It feels a little quick. It feels a little messy. Like, that's part of it, you know, and you have to mentally sort of get through that. And maybe people don't even notice that it didn't feel great that night. It just happens. So I think a lot of the mental work happens before you actually get out there, but there is definitely things, and you try and you learn and you self-evaluate and you figure out what worked. I mean, I know I don't hear the PA announcer every time. I wish I was better at that, but you get distracted and you deal with what's in front of you, and you sort of, you know, self-evaluate kind of how it went and try to prepare yourself to be better the next time out. And that's what's kind of cool about this, is like every game's different. And it's constant self-evaluation. You're just constantly trying to build to get better, you know, one step at a time.
That's great how you mentioned improving your confidence by the preparation aspect and watching film so you could be self-aware on the games that you just worked. Is there anything else for a young official who might be struggling with the mental toughness? What advice do you have for them to be able to block out that external noise?
Yeah, and I think mental toughness is a big deal, because look, if you get to a new level, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be hard, and the way that coaches and players communicate with you, it's sort of unfair. Like, you know, they come at you just because you're the new person to see how you're going to handle it. Okay. And, you know, let your guard down. It's okay to be vulnerable, especially with your crew, and to be honest, like, you're going to make mistakes. And I think accepting that you're not going to be perfect, and that we're just trying to be, when you're new too, I feel like you feel like this weight is on your shoulders because you don't know how firm your position is at that level yet, right? If you first get to varsity games or Division II, you're constantly being evaluated. And I think we probably put too much pressure on us, on ourselves. And try to referee free. Do what got you there. Don't try to be something different. And just trust yourself. Like, your recall, yeah, maybe you don't have the same experiences as some of the people on the floor, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're not as good as them. And trust. Everybody has doubt. That's okay. I couldn't say that enough. Like, you're going to have doubt, and you get better at dealing with it, and it gets easier. And you're going to build trust with people through repeated experiences, and it just takes time. And I know when I was young, I hated hearing that. And if I was a young person, and you can hate hearing that, and you can try to make that speed up as fast as you possibly can, but it just takes time, and it will get easier if you put the work in.
So true. Let's touch on leadership for a second. You're obviously around some greats with the likes of Monty, Mark, Joey, and everyone else that works with the NBA referees and all of the partners that you work with. For the individual looking to lead others, what are some important qualities they should have?
Yeah, I really love this topic. It was the thing that I missed the most. I managed the intramural program at Purdue for 6 years before I was a full-time NBA referee, and working with the students and, you know, building a culture and a program where we were trying to develop leaders and develop people and using material. Like, this was the fun stuff. And most of my reading and podcast from the professional development kind of side end up being on this sort of topic. And I feel like I wish I did a little bit more reading in the season than I do now, but I feel like every summer I end up getting on something, and it becomes this like really big motivational factor. You know, like, the job of any leader is to pull greatness out of people to try to accomplish, you know, a common goal. Right. And so I'll use this example from a positional leadership, but it's not limited to that. But the crew chief, or, you know, in college and high school, and the referee, their job as that positional leader is to make those other two referees on their crew the best versions of themselves. Like, that is your job as a leader. It's not going out and calling seven plays out of primary and thinking that that's how you're going to be a leader. It's, how do I get the most? And I know that we all sort of maybe judge the abilities of the people around us, but there's no secret that certain referees work better with other people because of what the culture and the environment that they build. Okay. And so, you know, I think as a leader, there's like two things. And so some of this specifically on trust, there's a guy named Tim Kite out of Columbus, Ohio. He has a podcast called the Focus F3 podcast. And they do some material and a lot of like leadership training, but he talked about, you know, respect and trust, I think, is really important. And you build trust in three areas. And you do that through repeated experiences over time through your behaviors: character, competence, and connection. Okay. The character element, I think, sort of, you know, speaks for itself in how we judge if somebody is a good person, but their morals and the way they communicate, and are they humble? Are they on time? Are they professional? How you would judge somebody from a character standpoint. The competence standpoint, in the information that they're giving you, does it truly help you? What's their level of expertise in refereeing? And then the connection is like, are they genuinely connecting and helping you get better? And, you know, the one thing about refereeing is we sort of probably know, you know, as a younger person coming in, we may already know, if if a new person has a game with Scott Foster tomorrow, that competence trust is probably already there, you know, which is a little bit different. But maybe the character and the connection piece aren't. And that may take a couple games. And same thing from a leadership perspective. If you get put in a leadership perspective, that just doesn't, you don't just walk in and then start thinking that you're going to give feedback right away and it's going to be instantly. I know positionally we get put in these positions, but you have to sort of judge, have you built these relationships? And so if you're new or you're younger on a staff, like the character, you know, for us, you know, we have, you know, rookies on our staff, like that character and that, you know, connection piece starts now. It doesn't start when you become a crew chief. It's already happening. And so if you have that, those relationships and even the competence element, people judge, I mean, you're certainly going to grow over time, but those things are being judged now. And so then when you're thrown in there, you don't become a different person. And leadership's, it's not all warm and fuzzy. It's okay to disagree about stuff. You know, I think that's the leader's job to be honest and to sort of uphold the culture and what we're trying to, accomplish collectively. But what you do leading up to the game and then the day of the game and then the locker room, I think is just such a big part of the leadership side of thing. And you're trying to serve the crew and get the most out of them. Then when you get on the floor, again, it's not coming out and calling eight plays out of primary. That's probably not getting the most out of your crew. It's having information available to make it easy. If you had a brand new referee and they're not good with the clocks and you really just need them to call obvious fouls, taking care of that and taking that burden away from them where they can referee freely. You know, I think that we can sort of freeze up referees new when we're like, just call your primary. I got everything else. And that can kind of like, it kind of frees people. I think it kind of can freeze them up where they're like, oh, I'm kind of, they get scared if something happens. And the best leaders that I've been around have sort of just allowed you to work. You go do what you do, okay? Now, it's probably not the best idea if it's your first game and you have two or three plays in Scott Foster's lap. That's probably not like the smartest decision in the world, but we can work with that and we'll figure out why you did that. And as long as we're, you know, honest and receiving of information, you know, we can get better from that moment. You know, I don't think it's probably the best thing. I know Javi used to talk about this a lot. It's not the best thing to probably call and go change an out-of-bounds play 20 seconds into the game, unless it's just so egregious that you have to. I think we can survive an out-of-bounds play 20 seconds into the game. I think the confidence and that young person that maybe be at lead, they're a little bit more important at that point. So, you know, and then I think a leader and how much information they have, do they take care of rules? Are they aware? Do they run the game? And then there's the courage element at the end of the game. Are you there when the crew needs you most? And so in game, I think that's a little bit of how we lead, you know, and then the post game dialogue is extremely important and it's okay to have disagreements, as long as we're respectful and honest. And I think those are conversations. And we obviously have the luxury of having the video in our locker room, which is a little bit different maybe for college crews or high school crews. But remember, we judge ourselves on our intentions, but others judge us on how they experience us. And so you may have to think about how you presented something and maybe how that could have been perceived amongst the crew as you sort of evaluate where you are from a leadership perspective.
A lot of great nuggets and gems in that last passage. I'm definitely going to go back and revisit some of that. I know you work with a lot of officials off the court, giving back to the game. You mentioned something in the notes that stood out, what makes referees elite. What are some of the differentiators and deciding factors that separate the good official from the great official?
You know, I think the cool thing about refereeing is that there's multiple ways at being successful. I mean, you think about Danny Crawford and Joey Crawford, maybe polar opposite referees in terms of what they did and what they were good at. And both became crew chiefs in game 7 of the finals. So, you know, there's no there's no one way to necessarily do this. We have aggressive referees, we have lesser aggressive, but we have really good communicators, we have really good play callers. I think there's definitely different ways to be successful. I think the one maybe common trait of the top, like the really elite people, is this burning desire to want to be elite and to be good, and this mindset of constantly trying to get better. And so that's sort of all the off the floor stuff. You know, how do you take care of your body, the rules work that you do, the video work you do, the preparation you do, and the honest self-evaluation that you have to try to get there. And that may be the most important part of this whole thing, is how much time and effort and competitive edge do you sort of kind of put into getting better and being intentional in the work that you do to try to get there. Because there's a lot of talented referees, but talent doesn't always, you know, equate to skill and success, you know, especially if people don't put the work into it. But that to me would be sort of the off the card stuff. But then you kind of get into all this, you can be elite in different areas. I mean, you have elite play callers where they just seem to always make the right decision, probably because mentally they're thinking their way through and they got really good eyes and they sequence to the right defender and they're going from defender to defender and they don't get stuck on the offensive player. And if they're off ball and they're in their secondary, they get to defenders early, which normally leads to success. You know, the longer we see a play, the better. And but you also, if you have good patience and you can see the play all the way to the finish, like those are all traits of elite play callers. And you have people mechanically, they're always in the right spot. You know, they're getting to positions early. They make it look so easy. They always have open angles and they maintain them. Like those are things that elite people from mechanical standpoint do. They, you have elite communicators. They just have this ability to, you know, some of it may be some witty and they're quick on their feet, but they have a way to constantly diffuse and they have the answers. And when somebody asks you a question, you're able to answer it and they're able to understand it and accept it. Maybe they can disagree with it, but they just have this trait. And so you can be elite in all these other things, and you can be successful. I think it really kind of comes down to, do you evaluate like, all right, I'm good at this, how do I get better? And I'm not good at this, what would it take me? And what does it look like to be good at this? And it's sort of a grind, you know, and you put a lot of effort in that and time. And you probably have some people around you that can be honest, in your inner circle. But it is fascinating, and you try to learn from other people and to figure out what makes them successful. And, it's just part of this journey, you know, really it's being, you know, being a referee.
Let's talk about court presence and, specifically size and stature for a minute. I've said this on record a few times. The height of an official is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you're 4 feet or 7 feet. If you can work, then you can work. But I don't think every official that might be small in stature feels that way. And sometimes they might try to overcompensate, maybe to project more strength, more than necessary. This has clearly had no lasting negative effect on you as you've ascended all the way up the ladder. I think you could bring value in this category. What would you say to officials who are affected by this, who might be a little insecure about their height? What would you say to them to help them improve?
Yeah, I would say not to be, you know, as simple as that is. I don't think it has anything to do with it. And really tall referees have to deal with a whole other different set of circumstances that, you know, they have to make adjustments to. And so, you know, just embrace who you are. And do you have to sort of project a little bigger than where you are? Yeah, you do. I mean, because if you're going to be small, but you're also really soft and passive, it's probably not a really good formula to project strength and confidence. I think you're right. People do they go overboard, and then, you know, people get, you know, labeled for having little person syndrome or whatever. And I think you hear some of that kind of stuff. So much of refereeing, especially when it comes to court presence, there's such a delicate balance between it. It's not, you know, I think we all sort of understand that you want to be, you want to project strength and you want to be sharp, but you also want to have this sense of calm too. And you look comfortable and you don't feel, it doesn't look like it's the first time you've refereed and you've done it for a while. And it, and again, it's a really, really delicate balance. And so somebody said, well, I want you to get stronger. That maybe is just turning the dial from like a 6 to a 7, not a 6 to a 10. You know, we have a tendency to sort of overcorrect a little bit. And so I'm sure what happens is somebody's small and they feel like, well, you got to referee big, and we sort of overdo it. And so if you feel like you're overdoing it, just start moving the dial one turn at a time and then evaluate how that looks and then ask people around you how it looks. And so, and again, people have different perspectives and that's okay. You know, there's definitely different ways, and but let it go. It's not that big of a deal. You know, nobody talks about it, at least, you know, around, maybe people talk about it behind my back, but I don't think I have anybody talking about how small I am. And like I said, I think the really tall people, you know, Eddie Malloy does things, so he's not so tall and lanky. And so everybody sort of has something that they kind of deal with. And we all can't be, you know, 6'2" and built like Greek goddesses. So you just sort of got to work with what you got.
Appreciate that. You know, being a young prodigy like yourself, I'm sure you've worked with many partners that were older than you, more experienced. This happens to be a really big challenge for a lot of younger, less experienced officials for many reasons. It's a natural feeling of intimidation, not wanting to step on anyone's toes, a fear of blowing in a veteran's area. And unfortunately, not every veteran referee is looking to help out and give back. So how do you navigate being the youngest, newest, or least skilled official on the crew?
Yeah, I don't know about the prodigy comment. It's a little, I don't know if I'm gonna be accepting of that. I think with being the, like being the youngest isn't necessarily being the least skilled. You know, I think it's important to note that, in like, experience doesn't necessarily equal expertise. But when you're young, you have to respect the experiences that veteran referees have had. Okay. And the longer that you've been on this journey, the more battle scars you probably have. Okay. And there's so much negativity in refereeing that, and there's just way more negative things that can happen the longer that you're in this than pats on the back and these great things. And most of the time there's three referees that get that particular assignment on our staff. There's 12. And even within that 12, maybe somebody's not happy that they didn't get a crew chief assignment or game six. Or so it's, you got to think about it. It's kind of like teams. There's one team at the end of the year that's happy. So think about somebody that's maybe had a 20 or 30 year career. They've probably had these ups and downs amongst the journey that has wounded them a little bit. And so a lot of times you can sort of see that. And I think as a young person, you come in and you're ambitious and you have a lot of energy, and ignorance is a little bit of bliss, and it is truly innocence and it's excitement. But I think you also have to respect that veteran referee has been through a lot. Okay. And so normally when you're the younger person in the crew, you would do more listening than talking. Okay. And that energy and that you bring to the crew, there's nothing wrong with that. I would just respect that what maybe that veteran referee has been through, there can be some learning moments there. If it is somebody that maybe doesn't want to help you or they give you bad information, just take that information, listen to it. And once you leave, if it's no good, just throw it out. That's okay. Probably not the best to just fight back and say, well, so-and-so told me the other day. Like that can come across as a little bit disrespectful. And I sort of go back to that trust element a little bit, you know, hopefully, you know, and again, sometimes the environments are a little bit different, but if you know people and you've been building relationships leading up to this moment, you know, maybe it makes it a little bit easier. You've been helping somebody or it's somebody you looked up to. You already have a little bit of a connection there. But, you know, be yourself. Like, don't try to be something. Like, you, I feel like sometimes people get to the next level and then they feel like they got to be something different, or they're almost overly respectful. And it's just like, just be yourself. We got to try to learn who you are, but be humble. Okay. You know, I know that there's a tendency, or, you know, a tendency to sort of spend more time on the younger person's plays in the locker room and just sort of kind of maybe expect that and brush it off and not take that personal, because that can be overwhelming when you get back to the locker room and the conversation or the video plays that come up, like all five of them are yours. And you're like, well, I wasn't the only one that made mistakes out here tonight, you know? And so just accept it, you know, be good about it, be a good learner, be humble, you know, don't, yeah, at that moment, again, we talked about this earlier, you feel a little vulnerable with where your position is. You haven't sort of, you know, claimed a spot where you feel maybe secure. And so you can get a little unease and a little defensive. And I would advise everybody to sort of fight against that. You know, being confident's okay. But you also want to make sure that you're open to change and you hear other people's perspectives. There's a little good in everybody, and you can kind of, you can get a little bit of a nugget. And even if you don't fully agree with the full message, like there will definitely be times that somebody will provide a message in form of evaluation where it may not be the right play, but the message that they're trying to tell you is good to know. And it's so a little bit a matter of a perspective, and being able to sort of see through that a little bit is important. And then when you're the young person, I think this is extremely important. Moments and opportunities don't always just happen, but you got to be ready for them to happen. And you can't manufacture moments, but there's going to be a time where it could be a rule, or there could be a clock. Let's just say, you know, in our league, if we have a ball that goes off two defenders and it goes out of bounds, and we don't know who it went off with, and we go jump ball, it's not a jump ball as a result of a held ball, and so the shot clock goes to 24. If the crew is getting ready to mess that up and you have this moment and you step up and you fix that clock, that is a moment. That was an opportunity that you met. And so know the rules, try to do the little things that helps make the crew chief's job, or the, you know, whoever that person is, makes their job easier. And so also being a good young referee is just owning your primary, like putting a wall up around your primary where they don't have to worry about you. And so people, if you've been that and you're with people lesser experienced, you probably worry about stuff a little bit more. You take this onus of the game, you worry about the game a little bit more than you should. And so if you have people that are young that really can take care of their own business, that's a comforting feeling for your partners. So meeting the moment, again, from a rule standpoint, or you have this play and it opens up and you're not scared to go call it and you save the crew and it could be a flagrant foul from 40 feet away. Those are moments. And can you meet the moment, and are you ready to meet the moment? And they don't always happen. But you can't manufacture them trying to say, oh, I'm going to go out of my primary and pick this play up for them, and it's not the play. Like, you just tried to make something happen that really wasn't what we needed you to do. And so there's a lot that kind of goes into that, and you do sort of have to navigate it. And I would recommend having people you trust in a small circle, not a big circle of people you can kind of throw stuff by. But I think, you know, some of the younger people that I've had experiences with, you know, maybe some of the people that I help with Indiana, I've told them this, like, your circle doesn't have to be 15 people where you're sending a play, you know, 10 plays after every game. Like, that's a little big. Like, find 2 to 3 people that you can ultimately trust, where you can share ideas. And you probably want somebody that has a little bit more experience in you that can be honest and give you some information. But there's a lot of landmines in that, you know, unfortunately, somebody coming up and being young can be intimidating or can be threatening. You don't make the schedule. you know, like people get promoted on our staff and they go from an umpire to a referee, and maybe people don't believe that you deserve that, or maybe they do, but you don't make the schedule. It's not your fault, you know? And so being a good person and not changing because positionally you got a new position, you know, is important. And then you just work really hard and do everything you can. And so I mean, maybe sometimes you feel pressure when in those moments younger when you get promoted, and maybe internally don't know if you're ready for that, but be respectful, understand what veterans maybe have went through, you know, be yourself, you know, be really honest, and just work your butt off. You know, those are just things that young people can do, you know, to kind of be successful.
That was really, really helpful. And I definitely think it's going to help a lot of younger officials. That's definitely a hot topic. I remember the first time I worked with two Division I referees. It was an early college game for me. One of the referees was G's father.
Yeah.
And a fellow by the name of Chet Martin from Virginia. Chet, if you're listening, how you doing? But I remember I entered that game, and outside of my primary, I was not blowing the whistle anywhere. You know, and you have that fear of not wanting to step their toes, and where do you insert yourself in this game?
And that's what, and going back, because I made that comment earlier, I hope that the crew chief or the referee or the leader on that crew sort of makes it okay to go get a play. If you think that you see a foul, come call it. And even if maybe you don't truly believe that as the crew chief, I think at least emphasizing the importance of when you come out of your primary to go call something. I don't love that. Just stay in your primary. Cause I think that sort of handcuffs people. And it does, like, you have that, like, ooh, I don't know, that's so-and-so over there, I don't know if I want to go call that. I would advise, like, that if you wanted to sort of have that message, and look, I know that happens, and we have people that maybe are a little bit more reckless, and they're maybe too willing, that the messaging is more about the importance of when we come out and when we don't. But I don't know that you want to handcuff, because what happens if you really need them? And you need, again, the job of a leader is to pull the greatness out of those other two people on the crew. And I don't know that limiting them and lessening their job responsibilities is pulling out greatness.
We're all getting the same game fee, right?
Yes. Right.
So I know you mentioned how NBA players and coaches sometimes are not fair with the way they speak to you. That's obvious from a fan's point of view, you know, watching on TV, but obviously you've had to do some work on your end to improve your communication skills. So what have been some of the, you know, key factors that have helped you?
Yeah, it's definitely unfair. And again, it goes back to, and nobody really wants to hear that, it's going to just take time, right? And like, it's a matter of trust. And you think about other areas of your life, like, you kind of think about the areas in your life that you go to people because you trust them. And it's no different than what maybe how teams and people and management feel. Like, it's, you have to sort of earn that. And it's going to be hard in the moment. And it's unfair. I'll tell you a quick story. And I think this sort of shows you how unfair the communication element is. And because I get a little frustrated sometimes when they say, well, young people don't communicate. Well, they don't communicate the same way with us either, you know? And sometimes that's true. Like, you're trying to figure out how to communicate. And I remember being younger thinking there was like what buzzwords, like, what do people say to coaches? You know, you're trying to find, there's like no magic word. You know, I think it's important to be yourself. But so 6 years ago, so this would have been like December 2014. It's my last year in the D-League. Gotcha. Yeah, my last year in the D-League. I'm working like 10, 12 games in the Big Ten. I'm working NBA regular season games. I went to vet camp. At the snap of a finger, like, a lot of things went right. And so I have a game. I literally was my only non-Division I D-League NBA game. And it was on a Wednesday in like the first week of December in at Frankfurt or Franklin College. And they were playing Hanover. And I didn't know Hanover. I literally had this game, and it just the way the schedule went out, I'd already been turning enough games back. You know, I'm working this game. And so I'm with a friend of mine, Eric Lowe, and then a veteran that had been around for a while, Merlin Nice, was on the crew. And so we're talking in most conversations, people are talking about kind of where they've been and whatever. And, you know, I'm coming off a couple NBA games. I had, you know, some Division I games in the Big Ten, and you know, Eric was talking about kind of where we were going that weekend, and I had, you know, I think Michigan that Saturday, or I remember this week. So we come out, Hanover coaches this young guy, he's never seen me, and I'm like the U2 on the crew. It is what it is, right? And you come off these games, like in a Division III game, it is in like slow motion. It's not to necessarily say it's easier, because it gets kind of hard in that moment, right? So there's a play that happens, and I remember sort of my back on the other side of the table, and so the Hanover coach is kind of to my right, and like his player like kind of jumps, and he started like snaps his head, and I'm sure he's probably used to that. I'm just standing there like there's nothing, and he kind of looks, and then his guy goes to the rim, jumps into somebody, falls down, and he's like, nothing? And I'm like, no, I mean, it's just not a foul, you know? And so a block charge play happens a couple minutes later, and I can see this guy, like, this just energy's building over there, right? He's becoming upset. It's not a hard play, and there's another play, and he's kneeling down. He is, like, trying to just stare through me. And so we were at, like, the 12-minute mark of the first half or something, and this guy's kind of, like, he's pissed at me. He doesn't know who I am. It's no clue. So I'm at lead administering a free throw, two free throws, matter of fact, and Eric is over there, and this coach says, is this his first game in this league? Okay. Now, at this time, I'm like, I'm 29 years old. I look like I'm 20, 21, right? They has no idea who I am. And so, Eric, it's really funny because we kind of tell this, like, we've told this story, like I've told it publicly like this, but he says, this year in this league tonight, yes, that was his answer. Okay. And he goes, where is he from? And Eric responds, the NBA. And like I'm looking over and I'm watching this sort of happen, and I don't know every word, but I sort of see that part. And the guy, like, his jaw drops, and he's like, like the Indiana Pacers? And he's like, yeah. And Eric just kind of being, he's just sort of like poking the bear a little bit. He's like, if you want to see him, like, he'll be on TV Saturday or something. And the guy's like in shock, right? So we have like a media timeout. I want to say at like the 8-minute mark. And I went to Eric and I was like, did he just ask you where I work? And he's like, yeah, I'll tell you at halftime. This guy never said another word the rest of the half, right? Not a word. We get to maybe like 10 minutes left in the second half. He said something on maybe every other possession for the first 8 minutes of the game. There's this interaction. He doesn't say another word. I finally get over in front of his bench, and he walks up and he goes, I am so sorry, right? Because now all of a sudden I had credibility, and he didn't know it. And that, to me, is what's unfair about how coaches and teams like treat young people. They have no idea if you're good or not, okay? And so I just thought that story in that moment, it was hilarious. And like, I was like, look, like, it doesn't mean I'm not going to miss a play, you know? And I hope maybe it sort of changed how he maybe approached some young people, because you just never know who you're going to have on that particular game. So I do think that you just have to sort of be yourself and be a human being. And I think what happens when people are younger, we have a tendency to get defensive, and we maybe bark, or we're sort of lost for words on what to say. You know, I would imagine that teams and coaches would tell you that young people aren't as honest or willing to say when they're wrong, or you're a know-it-all, and you always sort of get labeled, you know, when you're younger, because they don't know you. And the biggest thing that I've sort of, you know, learned over the, you know, 6 years in the NBA is just be a human being. Like, that's sort of kind of like how it works. And it doesn't work with everybody, but being calm and being in control of your own emotions and sort of being able to respond. And probably your first interaction with that coach that night probably shouldn't be a debate over a play. At least find a way you know, to say hello or whatever it may be, or you know, you see somebody's kids are sick, or you know, they just win an award, or somebody gets a contract extension, you just genuinely just say something. I remember Monty being really good at being up to speed on what was going on in the league, and just, you know, he knew if somebody's, you know, kid was diagnosed with cancer, and he would say something, you know. And I think that he was sort of just, again, he was building trust and a connection there with that player. And it's not putting your arm around him and doing things that are disingenuous. Like, this is genuinely building a working relationship. And look, other people have different approaches. I'm just sharing you just some of the experiences that I've had and things that I think that have worked. But now I got the opportunity to be in an advisory council meeting. There was a committee formed, and there were different sessions, and they had brought in different referees and players, coaches, media members, people from the NBA. And there's so much that they don't know about what we do and what we go through and the pain and the, you know, a difficult play. They just think that we work the game and we leave. And I don't think they fully understand everything that goes into that. But being human and not being robotic and trying to be like this police officer sometimes, because it's kind of how we're viewed, and being able to connect, I think, is a really important communication piece. Now, look, sometimes you got to be stern and you got to take care of business because somebody just reaches that moment. But what you do up until then, and it doesn't always work. There are definitely some people that, like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to, plan B is going in place. And then it's plan C because A, you know, the first two things just didn't work. And so, think about it, visualize it. Like, I'm sort of preparing some communication for some upcoming stuff. So, like, you know, how you're going to meet that moment, because you know it's coming. There's no magic word you're going to say. And again, like I talked about earlier with doubt, like, they're going to put doubt in your mind. So some of that work that you put into it internally and how you're managing your own emotions, I think, is important too.
That was a great short story about when you dip down to work that D3 game that night. Just shows, though, that coaches are clueless with regards to which referees are talented or not. Their only criteria usually is this guy giving me calls? Can I speak to him? Like, is he listening to me? And okay, does he admit that he's wrong? That's the best thing that they love when we say is when we're wrong. But yet they get to evaluate us in on some levels. Go figure. Okay.
Look, there are a lot of flaws in the evaluation process. I think there's certainly merit into, you know, what their perspective is. They're a major stakeholder in the game, right? There are flaws, and I'm in college. It maybe doesn't weigh as much in high school. I remember the high school process, and it's like, it's 100% of the vote, and it's unfair, right? You know, and if you give a technical foul, and the way that people manipulate the system, and it's not their fault, you know, the system is flawed. And the evaluation processes have flaws in them. I mean, you think about, you know, the bosses, and they can only see so much of your work. And so, I, you know, I'm not going to sit here and complain about that. It's just the reality of what it is. And so it doesn't prevent you from still trying to be as good at that particular area as possible. And it's frustrating. And I'm sure it's different in different regions and different levels. And I'm sure it's continually a topic. But if you don't have a resolution to that particular problem, you know, I don't know how much good complaining does about it. You know, it is frustrating. I get it. But you just try to do your best with it. But you also, you want to make sure that you do what's right for the game at the standpoint. Don't sacrifice that because you're trying to chase a coach's vote or something like that. Again, it will take time. It will get better. And I remember early in my career, an assistant coach told me, Tyler, people are only going to respect technical fouls. And that may not be the only thing that they respect, but I remember that moment. And as much as they'll push back against it, they will respect it. You know, like there are some D-League coaches that I probably gave more technical fouls to, And over time, that relationship turns into respect. As long as you handle those moments the right way, professionally, respectfully, don't allow those things to get personal. A lot of times, some of those people you get technical, they gain respect for you and realize that you're willing to demonstrate strength. And then I think that it creates somewhat of a bond. And I think most of everybody on our staff would have somebody like that where maybe they bumped heads with early on and it was, you know, technicals in every game. And then this bond was formed where this working relationship ended up turning really good. But you got to go through those moments early on where it's uncomfortable. You know, and I know that can be challenging for people.
The key is being comfortable in the chaos. I know you had mentioned that in the show notes. You've spoke about it a little bit today on the podcast, but what are some of the keys with staying calm in the midst of chaos?
Yeah, this is a Tim Kite thing, but E plus R equals O, event plus response equals outcome, okay? And you only control your response. So the event happens, a situation happens. Your response is going to dictate the outcome. Yeah. Okay. So you can only control how your response is. And so I think the one thing with refereeing that, you know, just things happen in life and we just build a house or, you know, stuff would happen. And I was like, okay, well, how do we fix it? Like it doesn't emotionally just didn't rattle me as much. You know, like my wife will get fired up because, you know, the kids maybe have a fever or something happened in the house. Okay, like, what do we do now? Because it already happened. And so the only thing that you can sort of control is your response in that moment. And you just sort of go back, you know, to what you're used to doing. And so I've said this a couple of times, but you revert back to your training in the moments of chaos and your habits. So you build good habits and you just respond and you try to hopefully get to the best outcome you possibly can. You were dealt with this, you know? So, you know, it's snowing, right? You know, an event happened. How are you going to get to the game? You leave a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. If you want to be there on time, you leave a little bit earlier just because you have to, and that seems so simple, but complaining about it isn't going to do us any good, right? Everybody has travel issues. It's just something as referees, you got to deal with. And again, in the midst of all this, people are going to put doubt in your mind and you just that's the reality. It's this stuff is hard. It's not clear cut. You think about the amount of plays that we put up as referees and the room is torn. Okay. And if we who do this, okay, can't figure it out, what do you expect the sidelines and the fans to do? They get their fans, right? And sometimes the job can be hard, but you fight through it. You try to stay as calm as possible. You control your response. That's the only thing you control.
Controlling what you can control. Love it. So I recently put out, just to make it a little bit interactive, I polled the audience on some questions that they would like to ask you for this podcast. So I picked 8 of the best questions I found, and we're going to do a little speed round. How's that sound?
Okay. Sounds good.
First questions from a friend of the show, Fabian Gerara. How do you handle negativity and many times incorrect comments from broadcasters?
To be honest, depending on the crew, I don't even listen to it. So, does it get frustrating? Yeah, you just try to, again, you brush it off. And I just kind of was hitting on that a little bit. It is what it is. Those are those experiences, their experiences and how they view it. But I think you just have to trust that you probably are a little bit more of an expert in this particular field. And I'm not trying to tell them how, you know, certain levels of broadcasts or coaches how to draw up certain plays. So just do what you do. Try to block that kind of stuff out.
Maybe we can get Breeny, Van Gundy, and Jackson to listen to the podcast more. Maybe update their repertoire so that they can communicate correctly to the wide range of listeners and people watching the games. Next question is from Ron Wilcots. Shout out to Ron Wilcots, by the way, because he was the first person to take me up on the Crown Refs IPR service, which is our film review service. We're up to number 33 right now, so I had to give a little shameless plug. Tyler, you like that?
Nice. Very well done. That's why you're the host.
Ron Wilcots, what is one thing you learned that has always stuck with you as you advance your career?
Ooh, What is one thing that I've learned that's always stuck with me? This is supposed to be rapid fire too.
All right. No shot clock.
Yeah. I just think effort, man. I really do. Like, you just, the time you put into it. And I think that people recognize that but it leads to success. And so you just try to be yourself and do what got you here. Don't try to do something different. So for me, it's putting time into it and just trying to grind to be as good as I possibly can. And so I've just kept doing that and just trying to be who I am. But look, your perspectives change. Like, experience, if I went back and saw how I judged plays 5 years ago, it would be different. Like, you evolve from that, and you maybe don't feel it like in the moment. You, as you go, like, you don't know what you don't know. And there's a lot of referees right now that where they are and they think, yeah, I feel pretty good. Like, I feel like I know a lot. And you think about it, in 5 years, you're going to feel very differently, you know? And so it's kind of an interesting thing as you go by. And I think the more that you go through this, the more you learn, but you just kind of stay true to yourself, you know, and you just, you put into this what you want to get out of it.
Absolutely. Next question. I don't think this is his government name. It's from Macaroni Tony. You must love macaroni and cheese. My daughter's a big macaroni and cheese. So I can't hate. What do you do before a game to get focused?
I just try to keep my routine the same, you know, whatever it may be, you know, every single game. And so, like, the morning, normally there's a workout. We have a morning meeting, lunch. The current circumstances completely throw some of that stuff out because we're like almost in isolation mode here. But I will research the teams in the morning and sort of look, are they on a losing streak? So, you know, is there, who's in, who's out, you know, what's the storyline? You know, sometimes if somebody's a really bad defensive team or they're really bad rebounding, you can tell that that's going to be a point of emphasis. And if it's just information that you sort of kind of gives you an idea of maybe what that game is going to look like. I will start thinking about the personalities that we have and the matchup problems that we have. We'll discuss that as a crew. But sort of that, you know, visualizing, maybe if you have, you know, you have a difficult coach or a difficult player, thinking about maybe how you're, what you're going to say in those particular moments, sort of visualizing plays, thinking about the maybe the couple points of emphasis that you have individually. Like, that stuff kind of all goes through the day, and also getting your body ready, you know, how we're, you know, what everybody, you know, tends to do. But I am, like, fascinated with how do you get to that top level of mental sharpness every night? And so is that nutrition? Is that hydration? Is that sleep? Is that the types of food? Is it when you, like, caffeine intake? Like, I'm always trying to, like, playing with, you know, what's the perfect formula to sort of getting there. And so you keep a consistent routine. You sort of think your way through the game in advance, and you do work for maybe your previous game, and you sort of prepare for what that night may throw at you.
This is a really fun question. I don't think anyone's asked you this. Little FIBA flair here. Anna Referee, what is your favorite officiating signal?
My favorite officiating signal?
Wow. What do you love to do the most?
That's a good question. You know, probably, like, you know, block charge probably becomes the most fun just because it ends up having, like, the most energy, right? Like, those plays have their bang bang, and, you know, there's always this sort of, like, people have doubt on these kind of plays. So that's probably the most fun. Most of the other ones we're just doing when we're reporting in a very calm manner. So those ones that you really got a lot of energy behind, I think probably become the most fun.
Now, that's the most fun play type, if you had to pick, block or charge?
The signal?
Yeah. Anna wants to know.
I don't know. I don't know. Block?
Okay.
You know, I don't know that I'm passionately one way or the other there.
You know what my favorite signal is? I don't get to do it because I'm not in the NBA. Loose ball foul.
Oh, yeah.
Love it. I actually do get to do it because when I report my timeouts – at the table, full timeout, I go loose ball.
Yeah.
Similar.
I don't Envy, JD is a, JD's a friend of mine. I know he's very passionate about stopping the clock. I don't miss those days of having to stop the clock on like out of bounds signals and stuff. But hey, when in Rome, do as the Romans.
I love stopping the clock.
Good.
JD's listening to time. Yeah.
That's a good message.
Hunter Gomez, how do you deal with players and coaches that try to intimidate you because you're young?
I think that's just a little bit of a self-belief, right? Like, I don't know that sort of rattles me. We have stars in that sort of can try to do that, but you make eye contact and you just talk right to them. Like, you're not a jerk about it, but you can't back down and be passive. And you sort of demonstrate, like, I am not going to back down here. Like, you're not going to intimidate me. But I think the eye contact piece is important, your body language and what your nonverbals are saying, and you listen and you communicate and you don't get into this little battle of who's going to have the last word. But I think that just those little things and having some internal confidence, it sort of shows like, okay, you're not going to intimidate me. That's fine. You know, and staying, controlling your own emotions, control what you control. Like I said, E plus R equals O, you control your response, and that's what you can do. And over time it will get better and they'll respect you for that. But don't try to be a know-it-all. Don't try to be a wise guy. Don't try to, and don't get scared, you know, because they'll feed off of that for sure.
All right. Three more, two little intramural questions here. I'm sure. Ryan, how can intramural officiating prepare an official for higher levels?
Yeah. Well, I think the really cool thing about the intramural world, and I've been in that world for a long time, is how much energy goes into training and development. And so typically your intramural referees have way more training than somebody that just decides they're going to go to their local high school board and become a referee. And so there's a huge advantage there. I even think that some of the intramural basketball that you have at the highest level on some of these campuses, these really good teams, it may be better than some of the high school games. It's structured. You don't have the coach or the table, you know, the fans sometimes. You don't have maybe that, the administrative things that come with that, because intramurals may have their own rules in terms of jerseys or subs or fouls or clocks or whatever that may be. But definitely from a training and development standpoint, and I know that a lot of intramural referees, we face this, they didn't know if they were ready. You're absolutely ready if you have a program and a structure in place that is training and preparing you to be a referee. And there's a lot of really good intramural programs out there that do that.
Mr. Intramural himself, Tom St. John, if the NBA didn't work out, could you have seen yourself as a campus ref professional?
Well, I was in that. Yeah. So, I mean, I was certainly doing that at the time. Like there was a point, you know, like, I don't know how much further along, if I wasn't in the NBA, how we would have balanced maybe college and stuff with intramurals. You know, the one thing about intramural professionals, it takes a great deal of time to be really good at that. You know, at Purdue, we had 300 basketball. I mean, we had 3,000 teams a year playing intramurals and a staff of like 160 different people. Like, that is a lot of stuff. And so there were a lot of 70-hour work weeks. And so there were definitely things that I enjoyed and that I don't miss. But I definitely miss the student development mentorship portion of what that become. I think that I probably would have stayed in there and worked side by side and just been stressed out for a while.
Well, I really appreciate you answering those questions and spending a lot of time. A lot of content to go back and digest. Is there anything else that you want to say to the community of officials that are listening now?
No, I mean, just take care of each other. You know, I see some of this stuff that gets, I'm not a big social media person, but some of these Facebook groups that are out there and the amount of complaining that other referees do about other referees watching a game and saying, did he get that call right, or him or her, did they get that call right or wrong, is different than posting something on Facebook and bashing, you know. And so I think from a culture standpoint, we should aspire to be better because we are all we have. And I've gotten frustrated by seeing some of it. Now I just don't even pay attention to it. But if you're in those groups, I would just think about the culture of what you would want your team of your conference or your board or whatever, like what you would want that to look like. And, you know, try to make a positive impact, you know, on that. Because there's enough negativity, you know, in these other, you know, these other forums and fans and coaches and teams and broadcasters that will certainly be enough. So, you know, be supportive of each other. And yeah, I mean, good luck to everybody. I think it's cool. I mean, obviously, if somebody's listening to this podcast, it's somebody that's taking it serious and they're certainly trying to work to get better. And you just grind and you be hard on yourself, but also believe in yourself. So, and good luck to everybody.
Thank you so much for that, Tyler. I really appreciate it. And have a great rest of your season. We'll be rooting for you.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs Podcast. Serve the game.
Hi, this is Corbin Cruy. The Crown Refs IPR service has been such a great tool for me as a young official. It has allowed me to take my game to a new level so early and so fast after reading through the notes, watching the film again with Paul's game notes. It's just taken my game to a new level instantly. The service that you get such one-on-one great service from Paul. He breaks down your game to the nth degree in terms of just the little things that make you that much better as an official. And after sending my film off and going back through it, getting back on the court the days and weeks just right after has made me feel like a brand new official. The calmness, the confidence, and the demeanor that I show on the court now and the way I report and the way I look has just been an instant change after reading through this. And I would tell any young official or any official that is looking to take their game to the highest of levels that the Crown Refs IPR service is that tool. And it's something that, for me, I'll build on for years to come as a foundational tool and look forward to being a lifelong client of the Crown Refs podcast. Serve the game.